From KLCC Studios, this is Oregon on the Record.
I'm Michael Dunn. Antarctic ice is a perfect medium to study events over amazingly long periods of time. Unlike our seasonal freeze and thaws, the deep cold of the polar regions lock molecules in place for millions of years. That condition has led OSU researchers to sample the Antarctic ice and discover much older carbon molecules than previously found. Today on the show, you'll hear from the lead researcher about how this discovery is changing our understanding of global warming. Then, in the second part of the show, we talk with our reporter about two exciting occurrences going on in Corvallis to help those living unhoused and those needing low-cost mental health services. That's next on Oregon on the Record. Being a researcher means spending lots of time in a lab, and for most of these people, they can enjoy a laboratory that's climate-controlled and comfortable. But for some researchers, their lab is one of the most inhospitable and harsh environments on the planet, Antarctica. Today on the show, you'll meet one such hardy soul, a researcher from OSU who, along with a team, has discovered new carbon deposits deep in the polar ice that's resetting our understanding of global warming and what our planet was like 3 million years ago. Julia Marks Peterson, a doctoral student at Oregon State University. Julia, thanks so much for coming on and talking with us.
Oh, it's so great to be here.
Yeah. So you co-led a study about climate records as seen in ice samples. Tell us just generally what your study found.
Yeah. So I am part of a large science and technology center called the Center for Oldest Ice Exploration. And my work has been trying to get a measure of carbon dioxide concentrations and methane concentrations of the atmosphere going farther back than we have from previous ice cores.
Okay.
And so we have now found carbon dioxide and methane concentrations as far back as 3 million years.
Wow. So tell us why ice is the perfect medium for this study. Why does it trap carbon dioxide and methane?
Yeah, ice is very cool. So the ice that we're drilling in Antarctica is not like the ice that you find in your freezer. This is snow that was once snow on the top of an ice sheet that eventually gets compacted and transformed into ice. And what's special about that is that there is all this air that was once part of the fluffy snow that gets compacted into small bubbles. And those bubbles represent ancient atmosphere. So when we extract the gases in those bubbles, we can measure them for past atmospheric concentrations of carbon dioxide and methane and a lot of other things as well that give us a sense of the climate of the past.
Okay. Well, and for people listening, tell us why this is important. Tell us why this study and what you found is obviously worth studying, and also what is the information it's telling you?
Right. So it's we're finding ice that is even older than records that we found from Antarctica in the past, going back to 3 million years. And we're going farther into the past, into a period of Earth's history that we know was warmer than today, about 2 to 3 degrees warmer globally. And so these are really interesting periods in Earth's history when we often think of them as analogs for future warming. And so having a better sense of what the climate looked like is really critical to our understanding of what our future might look like. And carbon dioxide concentrations are a really important piece of the puzzle, and ice cores are that critical tool that we can use to get carbon dioxide concentrations.
Why doesn't ice degrade? Why is it, as we talked about, this medium of trapping these bubbles? I always think of ice as something very sensitive. You know, once it warms, it melts and whatnot, but obviously it can preserve for 3 million years or such.
Right. Yes, it's you have to go to very special places. So Antarctica has had ice that has been kind of stuck around, not just melting off in the summer, for the last approximately 35 million years. And so you're right that there are lots of places where the ice eventually does melt in Antarctica, but there are certain locations where we think that the ice kind of gets stuck. And so we're at a place called the Allen Hills, which is right next to the Transantarctic Mountains. And the ice that was once in the interior of the ice sheet has kind of migrated to this area and almost kind of gotten stuck right next to the mountains. And so we think that's kind of why it's preserved.
Okay. Boy, I can't imagine a more harsh environment for a laboratory as Antarctica. Talk a little bit about that challenge as well, because obviously, as you said, it's the perfect place to find what you need to find, but gosh, it's got to be one of the most brutal places on Earth.
Yes, I mean, it's very true. I was lucky to be part of two different field seasons drilling ice cores at the Allen Hills. And I'll say one of the things about the Allen Hills that makes it unique for finding old ice as well is that there's a lot of wind. It's a very windy place. There's a lot of this, the ice on the surface is getting scoured. And so the old ice that's come from below is uplifting and coming to the surface. So that's part of why we're getting old ice at these locations. But yes, it's very windy. So when you think about the wind chill at a place like this, you can get down to negative 40 degrees, and it's quite cold, and you definitely don't want any skin exposed. And you live there for upwards of 2 months on the ice, drilling ice cores 7 days a week. So it's a lot of work, and you could call it type two fun.
Okay, that makes sense. Do you analyze the ice cores there, or do you need to send it to OSU and the lab that you're part of? How does, once you get the ice core, take us through the analyzation process?
Right, yeah. So we drill these ice cores. They come up from from the ice sheet 1 meter at a time, and the responsibility of the scientists is to package them up, make sure you don't forget where you are in depth and which way is up. And then those boxes get shipped back to McMurdo Station, which is the largest station in Antarctica, where they eventually get put onto a refrigerated space in on a ship that then travels all the way back to actually to California. And then a refrigerated truck meets the ship, and they get trucked overnight to Denver, where the National Ice Core Facility is housed. And that is where all of the ice will sit until all the scientists come and subsample. So we cut up the ice and take it to different labs. And so the pieces of ice that come to Oregon State University are specifically to measure greenhouse gas concentrations like carbon dioxide and methane.
I see. I see. Let me quickly reintroduce you to the audience. We're talking with Julia Marks Peterson. She's a doctoral student at OSU, talking about her study about the ice and the age of carbon dioxide and methane in the ice and what that's leading toward. I always think of, and maybe this is an inapt analogy, but I think of, and we're all kind of used to tree rings showing the age of a particular tree. If it's cut down, you can count the rings. Does ice core samples, does it kind of work like that? That there's a certain depth tells you how old a particular core is?
Absolutely. And that is actually the analogy we use when we're teaching about ice cores is tree rings, because it's the thing people usually know. It is very similar. So except at a place like the Allen Hills, it's a unique place to be drilling ice cores. So conventional ice cores come from places at like high points of ice sheets, so at summits or domes where when you're walking on snow and right, that snow eventually transforms into ice. And when you drill down into the ice sheet, you're going back in time. You're going through those layers, and those layers are nicely in order. And the challenge of working at a place like the Allen Hills is that all of those beautifully in order layers have flowed to this region. And in that journey, they have gone tens of kilometers and they've gotten all mixed up. And so it's actually difficult to figure out exactly where you are in time. And actually dating this ice was the biggest challenge for decades, trying to figure out how old the ice probably was.
I see. So take us through, you talked about this, but I want to expand a little bit more. Take us through how the findings in your study might influence our understanding of the impact of climate change that we're experiencing right now.
Right. So we're finding carbon dioxide concentrations and methane concentrations from these earlier periods in Earth's climate that where we know that global temperatures were warmer and are often considered an analog for future warming. There are other ways to get carbon dioxide from kind of indirect ways using deep sea sediment cores. And those have always kind of, there's been this widely accepted understanding that carbon dioxide was probably closer to what it is today from the burning of fossil fuels. So back around 3 million years ago, it's been kind of accepted by the scientific community that carbon dioxide might have been as high as 400 parts per million, which again is similar to today. And what we have found is actually carbon dioxide in those earlier periods was about 250 parts per million. So quite a bit lower than the widely accepted levels. And you know, there's a couple ways to look at that, and certainly we need to learn more and do more work to fully understand the implications of our study. But you know, one way to look at that is that, you know, for a small change in carbon dioxide, we see quite a large change in temperature, and that could tell us that actually Earth is even more sensitive to carbon dioxide than we've previously understood.
When you conduct a study like this that's rather groundbreaking, what's your hope for, you know, advancing understanding?
Yeah, so, you know, I'm a paleoclimatologist, and I just love thinking about how we can use these archives of Earth that exist all over the globe that you can put together to tell you this, like, puzzle of what the Earth used to look like. So I just find that to be really fascinating. And I think adding new information about parts of Earth's past that are really intriguing is just very thrilling. But of course, the point of it all is to, you know, use our past to better understand our future. So I really am hopeful that the scientific community can use our new data and use climate models and their own observations of the Earth's climate to better understand what this might mean for our future.
She is Julia Marks-Peterson. She's a doctoral student at OSU, talking about ice and better understanding of carbon dioxide throughout the history of the Earth. Thank you so much for coming on and talking to our audience.
It was a pleasure. Thank you, Michael.
Our reporter, Macy Moore, joins us now to talk about two of her latest stories from Corvallis. Macy Moore, reporter for us here at KLCC. Great to see you in studio. How are you?
Doing good. How are you?
I'm well. I'm thinking of maybe introducing you as our Corvallis bureau chief, because you've got two very important stories that you covered emanating from Corvallis. Let's take the first one, which is about this great new supportive housing complex going up in Corvallis. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so it's in sort of what we call South Town of Corvallis. There was a previous shelter there, but now that shelter has been taken down to turn into this housing structure called Third Street Commons. They just had the groundbreaking last week, and it's going to be 47 units of permanent supportive housing, which basically means that it's housing first, so you don't have to meet any like specific qualifications of usually it's employment or sobriety are the most common with unhoused populations.
Okay.
To get into a housing complex. Here, you don't have to meet any of those qualifications, and you can get into this like permanent low rent housing with extra support structures, which for this facility is mostly like mental health care, case management, and other like health and medical issues.
Okay. Is this relatively new to Corvallis, this model of housing?
This is the first ever housing structure that's going to be like this. It's being done by Corvallis Housing First, which operates a lot of like unhoused population outreach and other community services and shelters in the area. Mm-hmm. But this is like the first of its kind in Corvallis of a permanent supporting housing model. It apparently, according to their director, works very well in other parts of the country. And they're really excited to get to introduce something like this to Corvallis.
Obviously, people without homes, homelessness, the unhoused, it's such a huge issue throughout our entire community. Has Corvallis kind of seen this problem increase like other communities, like here in Eugene?
I think definitely yes. And I also see a lot of really great like sort of activism around it and people working towards improving the homelessness situation in Corvallis. I know Oregon is pretty high up in the country for like our unhoused population. So I think Corvallis has seen an increase and they're hoping that this shelter will sort of help people dealing with chronic homelessness from some issues that you might not always be able to get covered in a shelter. Mm-hmm. So really bringing in that healthcare aspect and that like in person right there, very easy to access case management should help folks who have been really dealing with chronic homelessness get into a better situation.
I would imagine that if this works well, this could be a model and perhaps when you talk to the people there, is it the hope that more of these types of shelters will be built?
They definitely said that this is their sort of, this is the ideal shelter situation, one that's going to make the most impact because of all of the resources and the way it's being very like thoughtfully designed. It's going to be completely accessible for people dealing with disabilities. And it's kind of interesting, like they highlighted how this shelter is going to have like, it's almost going to be the best way you can describe it is like motel style where there's no internal hallways. So that really helps for safety and access to the outdoors. So this is like a very thoughtfully designed shelter that I think they would love to continue to implement. And permanent supportive housing is the best form of shelters currently available in the United States.
47 units is sizable, but it's not huge. Did you get any idea of what the need in Corvallis is? If they could, wave a magic wand or something and have more of these types of shelters, have any idea how many more they would need?
I'm not 100% sure on like the hard numbers.
Okay.
But when I was talking with the director, she kind of said the same thing, where it's like, it's a lot of housing, but it's not like, obviously, it's not going to cover everyone. But she's hoping that this will make a good dent and can sort of continue to legitimize and help them get funding. And, if the program goes well, you keep getting funded and you can build more housing and continue to help more of the community. So they kind of said this is like a small start, but hopefully a big step.
And we hear that a lot, is that this crisis took years and years to create. It's going to take time and little steps to get us out of it. Let's switch to the other one because it has a mental health capacity or a mental health a component, which you just talked about with this housing unit. But it's kind of interesting with the OSU psychology training clinic opening. Talk about that.
Yeah. So the clinic's been actually running, helping just OSU students for about 5 months. It's a part of a little bit of a newer. It's about 10 years the OSU clinical psychology doctorate has been around. Mm-hmm. So there are 6 doctorate students who are working at this training clinic. And they're taking like weekly therapy patients now from the entire community and doing assessments for stuff like ADHD or OCD for mostly adults, but assessments are for 14 and up. And it's just opening up to the community now. So anyone outside of OSU can reach out to them and see if they would be a good fit for care. It's obviously a training clinic, so first and foremost, it's for teaching students, and they're observed and supervised by licensed psychologists, so they can learn how to be the best possible clinicians and care providers. And because you're getting your care from students, it's going to be at a low cost. Right now, it's free, but once they finalize their pricing structure in the future, it'll be a sliding scale. I think it maxes out at about $50 per session.
Which is very reasonable compared to other options. I'm curious because I've talked to many people who point to Oregon being incredibly low in spending for mental health services. nationally, it's a big issue, and certainly throughout our community. And I'm wondering, you know, this sounds like a great model as kind of a way in which to offer that kind of services to people in a place that needs it desperately.
Yeah, and they've already seen this sort of got announced that it was opening to the community about a week ago. They've already seen huge demand for people really interested in using the training clinic. I think especially that low cost aspect makes it so accessible for folks. And the director of the clinic was, she's like, we were almost overwhelmed with how excited people are about the clinic. And it sort of emphasizes to her the mission statement, which is to teach these students to be the best possible, most innovative clinicians they can be, because hopefully once they're done getting their doctorate and going through the training clinic, they'll go out into mental health care in Oregon and continue to try to bridge that gap.
I imagine they're going to be quite busy. Do they have, is there capacity constraints? I mean, six students isn't a lot, but I imagine, you know, they're going to do the best they can.
That's basically what, since it's such a new program, the training clinic's really only been running for about 6 months. They're not 100% sure what their capacity is going to be like yet. They've already seen a lot of interest, but it's definitely, like, if you're looking for it and you're in the area, I would say it's worth reaching out. They're also going to start offering telehealth in the near future, so to sort of be able to expand those services outside of just Corvallis and being able to get to campus.
Okay. And I would imagine, I want to make sure I get this right, it's not necessarily for folks going through a mental health crisis. It's more, you know, someone who identifies a problem and needs some help.
Yeah. It's not, since it's not like a traditional clinic where you can get like that 24/7 sort of care, it's not for people going through like a severe, urgent mental health crisis. But if you're looking for assessment or it's like some ongoing therapy about some struggles that you're dealing with in your life, this might be a good fit.
Yeah. And I would imagine for the students, I mean, obviously you can get a lot in the classroom and learning from instructors, but this kind of real world experience must be tremendous.
Yeah, the director of the clinic said that it's kind of been like night and day over the last 6 months watching the students really grow as clinicians. It's pretty cool because in their like therapy rooms they have set up with cameras, and then there's sort of like a mission control room the next door over where other students and the supervisors will watch how the session's going. So they can always come in and intervene and help with the session, or they'll record it and you can look back on your work later. And it's, you know, the director said that you can't learn to be a therapist without just practicing therapy, and this is a really good way to do it where you can offer a low-cost service that can benefit patients, and you'll really benefit those students who are going to get a good learning experience back.
Some exciting stuff going on in Corvallis. Macy Moore, who reports for us, is part of the Reporting Fellow here at KLCC. Thanks so much for coming in and talking to us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
That's the show for today. All episodes of Oregon on the Record are available as a podcast at klcc.org. Tomorrow on the show, two stories of new entities coming to Oregon communities, one being met with consternation, one being met with excitement. First, we'll hear about a proposed Immigration and Customs Enforcement facility being proposed in Roseburg, and then we'll hear about how the new WNBA team in Portland, the Fire, is finally ready to ignite. I'm Michael Dunn, host of Oregon on the Record. Thanks for listening.